are now listening to the Music Matters Media Podcast with your host, Lisa Hollihan. A show made to bridge the gap between mainstream musicians and artists on the rise. Discovering up-and-coming musicians and discussing all things music. Don't forget to follow us on social media.
What's going on, Music Matters Media family? We are back with another super fun episode. I cannot wait to jump in to what we're going to be discussing today. Ever since Eric and I watched the documentary, The Greatest Night in Pop, because this documentary, first of all, I am, as Eric, huge into documentaries in general. Love watching a good documentary. Then you combine our love for music with a documentary, with a really good documentary, and it's just a match made in heaven.
Absolutely. Especially with the way this documentary was made. I mean, listen, a lot of the documentaries you and I watched have all been amazing ones, but there's nothing quite like getting a first person perspective on how something was made from beginning to end.
Yeah, truly incredible. The documentary, The Greatest Night in Pop, is based around the creation of the song We Are the World. And this documentary goes behind the scenes and you get to see literally all the footage of the song being created in that time period during 1985, with all of music's biggest pop stars, some of them at the peak of their career and all of them in their prime. So it really was just such a legendary night. And when you watch this documentary, you're literally watching a huge part of music history.
Now, before we dive in, I just want to give a little disclaimer. So for anybody who has already seen the documentary, and you're listening to us, we hope you enjoy this episode and we hope you get a lot out of it.
And oh, you will.
We hope that you maybe even join the conversation after you're done listening. Now, if you have not seen this documentary yet and you are listening to us first, we highly recommend you go watch it.
Yes, this thing was incredible.
Nothing we say here can truly do it justice.
No.
It's something you have to experience for yourself.
Yes.
However, we are not going to discourage you from listening to us. So while you wait to watch the documentary, there's nothing wrong with getting a little teaser from us.
Of course, of course. Eric and I both watched this documentary twice because it was so good. We both individually watched it and then we watched it together before recording this episode. And truly, it's one of those documentaries that I can see myself watching time and time again because it's just that interesting. And each time you watch it, you discover new things and pick out little nuggets of information and mannerisms and personalities and just so much going on in that room that night all at once. So before we go into all the details of it and some things that stood out to us, some of the highlights throughout the documentary and the footage of the night, I just want Eric real quick to give a breakdown to our listeners, because not only if you haven't seen the documentary, you might be a little lost slash intrigued about what we're about to discuss here, but there's also some people out there that have no idea what we're referring to and the significance of it and the impact that it made in music's history. So, Eric, would you care to give people some insight of why this night and why the creation of the song was so significant and important to music history?
Gladly. I will try to summarize it as best I can, and hopefully you guys will be able to take that and use it as your reference point if you want to further investigate, or if, of course, you want to watch the documentary, which we highly recommend you do.
Please go watch the documentary.
Your life will never be the same. If you're a fan of music, if you're a fan of pop music,
yeah,
trust me, this is essential viewing for you
all
guys.
Of 80s. Think about 80s and 90s biggest stars all together. I mean, truly phenomenal. I want to get into this. So, Eric, go ahead. Lay it out for us.
So, essentially, the concept for the single We Are the World was born from Harry Belafonte's desire to provide the American response to the single Do They Know It's Christmas, which was recorded by a British group called Band Aid in order to raise money for the 1983 through 1984 famine that was unfortunately ravaging Ethiopia. Essentially, Harry Belafonte wanted to join the cause and decided that America should get involved as well. And aside from raising money for Ethiopia, he also planned to raise money to end hunger in America as well. So it was, you know, a two...
Dual purpose.
Yes, it was a dual purpose, but the main focus was on Ethiopia. So to go about doing all of this, Harry reached out to someone called Ken Cragen, who was an entertainment manager and a fundraiser, who was responsible for managing Lionel Richie and Kenny Rogers. Quincy Jones, superstar producer, he produced Thriller. I mean...
Need we say more?
Exactly. I mean, all you have to do is look at someone's resume and see Thriller, and that's all you ever need to know about them. So he was brought on to co-produce the song, and due to his professional relationship to the Jacksons, Quincy contacted Michael Jackson. And thus began the meeting of the musical minds of two of the finest songwriters of the 80s. So, to speak a little more on that subject, Michael and Lionel got together to write the song, and it started with two melodies that Lionel Richie came up with, and then Michael added music to it. And Michael then got so passionate about the song that he actually completed it in one night, the basic structure of it at least. He created a demo with the basic structure of the song, complete with drums, piano, strings, and a chorus.
A true mastermind.
Now, obviously, for those of us who have followed Michael's career for all of our lives, and for those of us who even existed during the peak of his career, like us, in the 90s, we take something like this for granted, because as the consumer, we're getting the finished product, and it's an entire album of songs.
Right, right.
So to us, it's, you know, we're like, well, of course Michael can do this. He's Michael Jackson.
Yeah, you're not truly dissecting all of the intricacies that go into the creation behind even just one individual song, let alone a whole album.
Exactly. But for someone like Quincy Jones and Lionel Richie, which are two of his peers in the music industry, imagine being them in 1985 when Michael is arguably at the peak of his musical powers back then.
Oh yeah, he was in his prime.
Imagine, you know, being them, talking to Michael, having just done a Thriller, and then he comes back to you and says, I've already got the song. You know, to them, that was not only super impressive, but just shocking, because for someone to have such a clear idea of what a song needs, especially a song of a magnitude as We Are the World, I mean, to have such a clear view of what needs to go where, what needs to be included.
Exactly, when there was barely just bare bones, a skeleton structure of it, really.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, if this was just when Thriller came out, you know, Michael would have another 15 years worth of hits to provide the world with. So I can't even imagine what it must have been like from their perspective to, you know, have been witness to that. So that's essentially the gist of how it came about. And then obviously, once, you know, the songwriters were in place, once the producer was in place, then came the networking of it all.
Yes, the recruitment. How are we going to get all of these people with such star power that are also currently at their peak or their prime in their music career to get on this track and have this done simultaneously along with the video recording? Because they did both at the same time. They tracked the song and they got the footage, and thank God that they did, because that's how we got that insight into this documentary and the music video for the song and everything that comes along with it, because unfortunately a lot of the greats that were involved are no longer with us. So it's nice to get a perspective by watching the footage back, what their personalities were like together, how they creatively worked together, who was in charge of doing what, and just seeing everybody mesh and try to figure out their parts and where they fit within the song was just truly amazing, to not have to create that picture in your head, but to see that happen right in front of your very eyes. That's what really kept me engaged throughout. I mean, putting this documentary on from start to finish, it flew by because you're just so wrapped in to the story itself, and you're so mesmerized by all of these people and how they were able to pull this off that you can't look away.
And it's done in such a way that I don't know how it felt for you, but for me personally, I feel that the documentary is shot and in such a way, or rather the behind the scenes footage was shot in such a way, that you literally feel every emotion that these individuals go through. You feel the happiness, you feel the exhaustion.
Yeah, yeah.
Of starting to work at 10 at night, not leaving until 8 in the morning.
You know the expression of saying, oh, I wish I could be a fly on the wall of the creation of, you know, insert song here, insert album here. I only wish to be a fly on the wall. Watching that documentary, you got that experience firsthand, where you were literally transported back to 1985. And as you said, you're on that emotional roller coaster with all of these people, both individually and as a group. And I thought it did a really good job portraying how everybody felt, how everybody came together, and just the whole creative process throughout the night.
Yeah, and if you guys are wondering how we were able to get so many superstars under one roof, I can't blame you, and rather I don't blame you, for imagining what a logistical nightmare it would be. You know, we have done interviews in the past.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, Lisa here can tell you how hectic it is.
There's a lot of scheduling that goes on.
Scheduling, making sure that everybody's available the same day.
You got to accommodate people. You got to schedule people. You have to make sure that everything aligns perfectly in order to get it done. There's so many things that happen behind the scenes that people are completely unaware of. And this whole thing was exactly that, where everything literally, quite literally, had to come into alignment. And so much needed to happen behind the scenes to make this come into fruition, that by the time the public actually got the song, they had no idea all the blood, sweat, and tears that went into the making of it. They just wanted to support the cause and then also support their favorite musicians. And that goes hand in hand with something like this. When you're creating a charity single, that's the whole purpose and the driving force behind it. If you're a fan of XYZ on this track, come and support this single. That's going to be going to a great cause. But my love of this documentary comes from the process. And I love that in general in life. I think that's why I love documentaries so much, because I love seeing things from the ground up. It's so often in life, especially in the age of the internet and social media, where we always see the results. We see how things end. But very rarely do you get a behind the scenes look of everything that takes place for that person to end up where they're at. Normally, we just see the final results. We see the highlight reels. We see everything that's positive and great. But my fascination comes from watching things being built from the ground up. And then along with that, the journey, the struggles, the frustrations, the confusion, so on and so forth. Because to me, it makes the final product all the more rewarding. And even listening to the song now, I listen to the song differently now after watching the documentary, and I appreciate it so much more than I did just at face value before.
And how could you not? Especially when you take into account the musical landscape and the landscape of the technology today versus how it was back in 1985.
You could say that again.
Today,
yeah.
If you wanted to, You don't even have to be in the same room. You don't even have to be in the same country.
Yep. Nobody ever has to physically interact at any point.
Exactly. Now, transport yourself back to 1985. You have 40-something people all in the same room. So much potential for anything and everything to go wrong.
So many different musical styles and genres.
Having to do multiple takes just to get one thing right. And if you mess up, you've got to rewind all the way back to the beginning just to get it right.
Which they did. Yeah. Plenty of time, and we'll get to that, but...
Yeah, so damn right. You, of course, are going to have a newfound appreciation for something like this when you realize that they were able to make a masterpiece out of so many limitations back then.
And, two, I just want to note, they don't have all of the effects that we have today where you can go back in and edit something and make it sound even more spectacular than it actually is. They didn't have the technology of auto-tuning people's vocals and stitching things together the way that we do now where everything sounds like it's coming out flawlessly. People literally had to show up and give their best take, and that was the take that was chosen. And that was the song that was created. If it's now, I could come in, I can lay down vocals, and even though I'm no singer, they could make me sound incredible with the technology that we have today.
And that comparison is what makes each singer doing their solo takes that much more
amazing. So much respect.
Amazing.
So much respect for these people.
Because you realize, A, how much control they've got over their voice, and B, how hard they worked to really get their takes in just right.
And under that amount of stress and pressure and time constraint, and there was just everything that could be against a person in the most difficult environment. There's so many different things that you can point out of why this shouldn't have worked at all.
Yes, but as the saying goes, and I do believe I'm quoting this correctly, necessity is the mother of invention. And boy, did they really
Boy, did they deliver.
But in order for them to have gotten to that point, to have everybody under one roof, it all had to start somewhere. And so as he was brainstorming for a possible answer to that question, Ken Cragen said, what better way than to get everybody under one roof than to ask them to do this at the American Music Awards? And that was ultimately one of the key steps in being able to just bypass all this logistics stuff. They could just get everybody all in one shot.
So smart.
In one room. And not only, like, you know, get so many people in one room, but just the creme de la creme of the 80s.
Oh, yes. Speaking of, let me give a list here for those listening of who exactly was there that night in that room. I'm going to take it from the chorus, and then we'll get to the soloists. For the chorus, we have Dan Aykroyd, Harry Belafonte, Lindsey Buckingham, Mario Cipollina, Johnny Cola, Sheila E., Bob Geldof, Bill Gibson, Chris Hayes, Sean Hopper, Jackie Jackson, LaToya Jackson, Marlon Jackson, Randy Jackson, Tito Jackson, Waylon Jennings, Bette Midler, John Oates, Jeffrey Osborne, Anita Pointer, June Pointer, Ruth Pointer, all of the Pointer Sisters, Smokey Robinson, that's just for the chorus vocals alone. Then you have the main soloists, which were Lionel Richie, Stevie Wonder, Paul Simon, Kenny Rogers, James Ingram, Tina Turner, Billy Joel, Michael Jackson, Diana Ross, Diane Warwick, Willie Nelson, Al Jarreau, Bruce Springsteen, Kenny Loggins, Steve Perry, Daryl Hall, Huey Lewis, Cyndi Lauper, Kim Carnes, Bob Dylan, and Ray Charles.
How do you get any better than that?
Music royalty.
Music royalty is correct. I mean,
you could be in that room, you can look to your left, you can look to your right, and no matter where you look, you are looking at a certified superstar.
Absolutely. It's like Bob Dylan said when he was recording. He said, it's like a dream, isn't it? And he was right. I mean, my God. It's insane. And also, I just want to give a special shout out to the session musicians John J.R. Robinson on the drums, Louis Johnson on bass, and the pianist Greg Fillinganes. And the reason why I want to give these three a special shout out is because these three musicians first played together on Michael Jackson's song Don't Stop Till You Get Enough. So
that is amazing.
I mean, even they just brought their own star power to this. I mean, come on, they played on Thriller, played on one of the biggest hits off that album, and now they're being recruited for this? I mean, come on.
Also, I know we mentioned him prior, but just to reintroduce him, you have the conductor of it all, Quincy Jones.
Superstar. Absolute superstar. And, of course, we have to pay respect to Lionel Richie, who, of course, aside from being instrumental in the creation of this thing, he was partially in charge of just getting everybody together, but he was also in charge of hosting the AMAs that year.
All of music royalty at the time flew into California for the AMAs, otherwise known as the American Music Awards, that was hosted by Lionel Richie. Not only did Lionel Richie host the AMAs, which, as anybody knows who hosts any type of award show, weeks of preparation. But then you have him and these other musicians at the time who also performed at the AMAs, which also takes extreme preparation beforehand. Then to top everything else off, all of these people, especially Lionel, first and foremost, won these awards throughout the night. Swept. And you had this whole entire event go on that night that by the time it was finished and by the time Lionel rallied the troops, so to speak, it was all ready to start the night off to create this song and get everybody together. Was already 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah, these people, at the minute that the ceremony was done, they were just stepping out to their cars and going to the studio where this song was ultimately going to be recorded. And not only that, but the people who arranged this whole thing had to go through insane lengths to keep this confidential. They had
Which
to keep
you
the
could
place
have
a secret.
Never done in today's
not
times.
At all. Not at all. And even then, they were still worrying about leaks.
Yeah. Let me tell you, this whole experience and what makes this spectacular is from the story behind it to the creation of it to the final product to the impact, everything to do with this song. The reason what makes it such lightning in a bottle is exactly that, because you could never recreate something so sacred as this. Especially in the times that we're living in now, and it make the impact that it made. Because
exactly.
There is no, you mean to tell me that nobody would get on social media, take pictures, go on the internet, spread that like wildfire? That it's just impossible. It's not practical to keep something like that confidential nowadays. You kidding me? Everyday life for everybody, no matter who you are listening to this, is out there. Let alone,
yeah, absolutely.
Let alone music's biggest pop stars.
Yeah, I mean, you could almost say that being a leaker is borderline a professional job now, because
right.
Because it pays. I mean, let's be honest.
Right.
And so, like you said, I mean, it is. I've said this before on the podcast. The planets truly aligned that
yes.
night to bring everybody together to be able to carry out this insane task with as little errors as possible, given all of the obstacles that they were facing.
From the backstory of it, to the creation of it, the behind the scenes, to the people that they got on this thing, to the final product and the impact that they made, this whole experience and why they will forever hold a place in music history that night is because this was a lightning in a bottle, once in a lifetime opportunity that all of these musicians had and created together.
And that was just the organization of everything, getting everybody together, confirming who was going to be there. Now let's actually talk about the recording, because that was another task in and of itself.
Yes, and going into the details of the recording, just to give you guys a background idea of when they're doing this. Now we're going straight from the award show that everybody is already exhausted from, and they're going from 10 o'clock at night to 8 o'clock in the morning the following day is when everything was complete.
Yeah, and so throughout that time period, you want to talk about Lionel wearing so many hats. He had to supervise everybody.
Everybody.
Had to hit between him and Quincy. They had to make sure that whoever was doing a solo spot would come in at the right moment, that they had to sing in a certain range. And because the way this was recorded, they would pair up singers together. That was another task in and of itself, because you had to really...
Everybody's different ranges.
Exactly. Their styles. You had to make sure who was compatible with who. You know, who
it had to make
be.
Sense.
Exactly. It had to be cohesive.
And they're trying to figure this out in real time, which makes it so cool, because you're literally watching them as they figure out, okay, this person's going to be with this person could go with this person, we'll have a pair of them there, we'll have three of them there. It's really cool to watch everything unfold throughout the night as it's happening.
Yeah, it's really cool to see how the singers were physically positioned next to each other in order to be able to sing their parts. It's really cool to see how all the technology was arranged so that, you know, there could be as little glitches as possible. Obviously,
speaking about glitches, one of my favorite parts of the documentary, which I know that you got a kick out of too, is Cyndi Lauper.
Oh,
when
yeah.
She's doing her takes and they're trying to figure out what's that background noise because they can't pinpoint her vocals, and then hearing something all muddled in the background, and they're like, is it people laughing? What's going on here? Why is it? Is it her microphone? They were saying,
yeah,
and they're
yeah,
like,
yeah.
No, the microphone's fine. It's beautiful. And then they finally figured out that it was all the jewelry that she was wearing. She was wearing a pound's worth of necklaces and bracelets and earrings.
Yeah, she specifically
part of her
said,
style, of
she
course.
Said, oh my God, I'm loaded. And so she had to take time to take all of that stuff off and then record.
Yeah, because every time she went to the mic prior, you can hear the jingling of her jewelry, and that's what it ended up being, which was really funny.
Yeah, but it was moments like that, which was really endearing to see, that managed to break up the tension that was rising
yeah.
throughout the recording session. Because,
yeah, it gave some relief.
Yeah, because as you can imagine, you get 40-something of, at the time, the world's finest songwriters and amazing personalities in one roof. There's gonna be
tension. There's gonna be nerves, of course.
Yeah.
You have so many different personalities and so many different styles of vocals and genres, and then the nerves, of course, which is also extremely endearing. I do want to point that out as well, is that you can see everybody puts musicians and celebrities in general, it doesn't matter if they're athletes or whatever the case may be, on this pedestal. And you look up to these people and you place them on this pedestal and you treat them holier than thou. And this documentary really shatters that notion and that idea and humanizes these people, because you can see how incredibly nervous they were to do their parts and the second guessing and the questioning of their own confidence and abilities, because they feel that they're in a room surrounded with, which they were, the greatest of the great in music at the time. So it really kind of broke down all of that idea of anybody having a supreme ego or anything like that.
Right. Because, you know, when you think of musicians and their peers, that, you know, they're self-aware of their celebrity status or musical status, but what was really endearing about this was seeing how giddy everybody was around each other. You know, they're just freaking out that, you know, that they're in each other's presence, and they're acting more like fans of each other than peers.
I love that. I absolutely love that, because it really just humanized everybody and shattered that notion of, oh, I'm better than you, or I think super highly of myself and I'm the best singer in this room.
And to that point, you know, Lionel Richie and Quincy Jones really made sure to bring out the best in everybody.
Yes, I love the fact that Lionel too specifically to me felt like the glue of everybody getting together and meshing together and breaking the ice and trying to accommodate people the best that he could, working with all these different personalities like he did, and just to get everybody to sing and feel like they are at the best of their abilities throughout the night. When they are tired, they're hungry, they're nervous, there's a million emotions going on in that room, and none of it mattered because everybody was able to put that to the side and show up. But I truly believe none of that would have happened without Lionel Richie and Quincy Jones and Ken Cragen.
Absolutely. And in keeping in line with the slogan that they wrote, which is "Leave your ego at the door,"
I have a quick excerpt here. I'm glad that you brought that up. And it says, "A sign was taped to the studio door that read, 'Check your ego at the door.' Stevie Wonder greeted the musicians as they entered and said that if the recording was not complete in one take, he and Ray Charles, two blind men, would drive everybody home."
I love that so much.
Right? How hilarious is that?
But I love that in keeping with the spirit of that message that was taped to the door, Quincy and Lionel really made everybody feel that they were on an equal playing field. There was no best singer. There was no worst singer. There was none of that. There was no hierarchy. They truly made sure that everybody brought their best. And even the people who felt insecure a little bit, like Bob Dylan.
Can we talk about Bob Dylan for a second?
First of all, I just want to say that I relate to him the most out of everybody on this documentary, because I feel like had I been a part of that, he would have been exactly who I would have just, you know, acted like.
You could feel Bob Dylan's emotions through the screen.
Yeah, you could feel how shy he was.
How awkward he felt.
How possibly out of place he felt among everybody.
But you know what was the best? And I don't know if everybody caught this. It took me actually the second time watching the documentary to fully catch this. Was when he went over to the side with Stevie Wonder to rehearse his part. Because they were going over his part doing ad-libs. And he just felt super out of place and not extremely comfortable and confident in what he and his voice had to offer to the song. Because of that factor, he went off with Stevie Wonder to the side and they were trying to rehearse his part and come up with things. And Stevie Wonder mimicked Bob Dylan's voice and sung the ad-libs and the parts. And then that was enough for him to understand, oh yeah, that's great. That's something that I could do. All you guys ever wanted me to be was me. And I think that's truly beautiful.
Absolutely. And in order to... For the sake of being fair to Bob Dylan, it's like you said, he just needed to be himself, but at the same time, he wasn't totally off the mark with what he was doing, because initially, when he recorded the first couple of takes, Quincy Jones could hear that there was something there, because he went up to Bob Dylan and told him, this thing that you're doing, the way you're singing this, that's beautiful, man. Keep that up. And then, of course, Stevie took him to the side and essentially contextualized musically how he could sing it.
Which is brilliant if you think about it, because he's mimicking Bob Dylan for Bob Dylan. And then that was the moment that really everything clicked, where he was able to go back. He's like, okay, I got it now. And you could see the complete shift in his confidence and attitude towards the song. And he brought it. That's all they ever wanted, was his vocal style and his touch. And at first he felt awkward and unsure about why he was probably there in that room. But then after the fact, you can tell how he felt that he really truly accomplished what they set out to do there.
And just to speak a little bit more on that point of feeling uncomfortable and awkward and a little insecure, just imagine being in that room with so many powerhouse singers, and then imagine that you have to follow up whoever comes before you.
Let's talk about Huey Lewis following up Michael Jackson.
I don't envy him.
Tough position to be in, man. Oh man, following up Michael Jackson.
Yeah, and not only following up Michael Jackson.
Yeah, no pressure.
Not only following up Michael Jackson, but having to sing in a range that is a little outside of the one you're used to singing in, I mean, that was really what was tripping him up a little.
Definitely. Huey Lewis, Cyndi Lauper, and Kim Carnes all together, completely different vocal styles, but they were still able to manage to pull it off.
Yeah, definitely. And as if it wasn't enough to have to get everybody on the same page musically and bring out the best in them, you also just had to make sure that everybody was in agreement on how the whole thing would be carried out. And that is another just big risk to take, because Lionel Richie had to make sure that everybody agreed to do the song the way it was meant to be done. And matter of fact, he even said one of the worst things that you could say, or one of the things that you're not supposed to say ever when working with a lot of people, is, "I'm not sure about this, what do you think?"
Yeah, oh man, because that leaves so much room open, that leaves the door open for things to go completely off the rails, because then you have everybody giving their input and nobody's getting on the same page. And in order to make something like this work, putting the sign out there, "Check your ego at the door," that's something that everybody truly needed to do, as funny as it was. But that's another thing that I don't think, if you were to get all of the powerhouses and pop superstars of today in the same room, would they be able to do that? Eric, I truly believe that it just wouldn't be possible.
In a culture that, you know, pretty much says it's all about me.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't think so.
And what's crazy is that despite Lionel Richie's best efforts to make sure that everybody was on the same page, because he really left no room for anybody to really give their two cents, you still had that happening when Stevie Wonder said, "I think we should sing a line in Swahili." And then once that happened,
then everybody started losing it.
Yeah, some people didn't agree, to the point where Waylon Jennings said, "You know what? I'm out of here. This is too complicated for me to do."
Yeah.
And he actually ended up leaving.
He did his chorus part and then, yes. Yeah, he
now,
left.
The idea to go with the Swahili line was ultimately discarded. But the point of bringing all of this up is that you have to stay on track in order to
accomplish the
something
goal
like this.
Yeah,
exactly.
And to circle back, that's something that I absolutely adored and loved about Michael Jackson, is because the immense talent. I mean, we don't have enough time in an episode to go over the late great Michael Jackson.
Exactly. I mean, come on. All he has to do is stand still and you'll get people screaming.
But even with that, at no point throughout this whole process, and as shown in the documentary, did you ever see him putting anybody down or saying that he was better than anybody or acting like he was better than anybody. At no point did he ever act out or create any issues. And I think that's just as important to bring up and to credit him, because he was all about the greater good and the message behind the song and the impact, knowing the impact that this song was going to make. And having that in his foresight when making the song, I just think that it's truly a beautiful thing, and I definitely don't want this to be overlooked. He always wanted the best outcome, and he always wanted to bring the best out in everybody. And he loved the fact of the collaboration and getting the message out there of what they were trying to accomplish and making the impact. And that was his purpose. He put all, if any, ego that he had to the side, because to him, it was way more important to create this song and to get this message and make this impact and to get it out there. That's something that I truly loved about him, because he almost single-handedly made the song from front to back himself. He could have just took it upon himself to get on the track, sing it alone, put it out there, and do the whole entire thing on his own. But that wasn't the purpose, that wasn't the point, and that wasn't the message that he was trying to create. He wanted the collaboration, he wanted the unity, he wanted everybody to get together for the greater good, and that's something that I truly don't want to get overlooked here in this documentary, and just in general of who he was as a person.
Yeah, because the whole point of this whole collaboration was for it to be a humbling experience, which is why Bob Geldof at the beginning gave that speech. And he said, you know, nobody in that room can really know what it feels like to have nothing. But the people that they were going to be singing to know that because that's their reality every day. So that's why he said that, you know, that night was all about just collaboration and working together for a cause instead of, you know, bringing the celebrity aspect into the room with them.
And with that being said, I do want to quickly get into Sheila E. and Prince, because that was a part of the documentary that they focused on, the possible collaboration with Prince. Prince was offered to come sing on this track and be a part of this track, and he refused. He did not want to be in the same room with everybody else. They went back and forth with him over the phone. He offered possibly doing a guitar solo, but he wanted to be in a separate room. He wanted to do things separately. Whether that may be, there's two reasons in my mind that I do want to discuss here. There's whether that may be the first reason to chalk it up to Prince's personality and just the fact that he was very much introverted, especially creatively, and just the process of it all. This whole thing was more foreign to him of being surrounded by a group of people and collaborating and getting music done in that fashion. So they say about his personality and his creative process that he was more introverted, and just his personality in general, that he felt that way. However, my second assumption and analysis of the situation would be that at this time, Prince was in his prime, arguably the peak of his career. And then you have Michael Jackson, who is also at his prime during this time. It's 1985. They are going head to head at the American Music Awards. Prince took several awards that night, and the competition between the two was at an all-time high between Michael Jackson and Prince. And unfortunately, just my personal feeling, I felt as though he couldn't put his ego aside and be in the same room and record with Michael Jackson on this song because of that fact.
Yeah, you and I, it's probably the first thing we said when we watched the documentary together. You know, we agreed that, sure, there's truth to what Sheila E. had said, that he's not used to, you know, creating in an environment that's crowded, and that he wanted to just kind of be off to himself in order to, you know, give a good performance.
Prince had more of a loner vibe when it came to the creation of his music and his process and how he liked to get things done.
Right.
And
right.
You know what? I bet given the choice, more than half of those musicians in that room would have preferred to do what we do today and just record somewhere on your own and, okay, I'm going to send my bid in.
Of course.
But that was not the point.
Exactly. But the both of us agreed that, in our opinion, is perhaps the bigger reason for him deliberately missing out is because he just did not want to be in the same room with Michael Jackson.
Yep.
Because of just that rivalry that they had going on.
Yep.
And, well, unfortunately, we'll never know. And to be quite honest, that would be the reason why other collaborations that could have occurred between them ultimately never came to fruition. Like, Prince supposedly was offered to be on the song Bad. He says that he missed out on it because he didn't think he was needed for the song to be a hit. But really, he didn't want to set himself up for something that in his mind would make him look ridiculous. And that's why he ultimately ended up missing out on that. But you start to see a pattern as to why, you know, this possibly didn't happen.
So Sheila E. and Lionel Richie both were trying to reason with Prince over the phone and trying to potentially lure him to get him there, right, but ultimately declined his offer for a guitar solo and doing things separately and so on and so forth because, number one, that wasn't the purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't the point of them laying down this track together. Right. And then second, they didn't have the time to be doing all that. To imagine if they had to make accommodations for every single person.
Exactly.
From front to back, that's impossible to do that. So quite frankly, I am so glad that the rest of these musicians did not have the same sentiment as Prince, because as I told you that this wouldn't be able to go down present day, this song and potentially other collaborations for years to come would have never happened if everybody thought and acted that way.
Absolutely, because then that just creates unnecessary work and just unnecessary tension that nobody needs, especially on a time crunch like this.
Yes, I did love that throughout the documentary, even with the times where you could feel the tension in the room, it was more chalked up to the fact that these people were exhausted. But I will say that when it came to their time to lay down the vocals for their part, everybody brought their best.
Absolutely. And to go back to what you said before, you mentioned that nowadays, something like this can't be recreated for all the reasons you mentioned. Too many egos, you know, a shift in the technology, way too many opinions on what should be done, what shouldn't be done. And also, of course, there's just the impact of it, you know? Like, something like this, there's only one first time to do something like this. Everything else after that is just an offshoot of that. But let's talk about what this looked like when they did it for the 25th anniversary. I mean, you could make a case that these same problems that are present now reared their heads back then.
Yeah, 100%. I think that, first of all, I don't want to take away from the 25th anniversary. They did a recreation of We Are the World, and they did it for Haiti back in 2010. And they got the biggest names in music at the time, and some still today that hold up. And they got on the track and they tried to recreate something for charity like We Are the World. However, not knocking the effort and the cause behind it by any means, but you just cannot compare, even with the amount of technology, even with auto-tuning the vocals, just all those people in that room, they still had a lack of diversity, a lack of... With We Are the World, the original, you had every single genre you could possibly imagine in that room.
Mm-hmm.
And absolutely. I think one of the most highly criticized points, other than the auto-tuning of the vocals, was the lack thereof when they tried to do the remake, that it focused too much on certain genres more than others, and it really didn't paint as vivid of a picture of just how diverse we are. So, yeah, I mean, when it comes to the 25th anniversary, of course, appreciate the effort, appreciate the sentiment, appreciate the cause, and it was nice that they tried to recreate that moment in history. But as I said earlier, that was lightning in a bottle and a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And there's just nothing that's going to ever compare to it, and nothing that could ever come close to being remotely like it.
I totally agree with you, and I hadn't thought about that with We Are the World 25. I felt like they tried to... I mean, I know you're saying that they had only a certain set of styles, but musically, I felt like they tried to perhaps fit too many things into one song, and at some parts, it sounds a bit disjointed because of that.
Yeah.
But let's take into account other things. This time around, you had more time to plan the execution of the song. You had more
time number
to
one.
Reach out to people. And it was a relatively more seamless process than it had been in 1985.
Number two, you have the technology.
Exactly. And those things are ultimately what make the original as impactful as it was, because it was a spur-of-the-moment thing. It was something that they did while thinking on their feet. And it was just something that had never been done before in general. And the fact that they were able to just do this in such a limited window, have it exceed everybody's expectations, that's not something that you can repeat ever again.
And all of those raw vocal styles. I loved watching Bruce Springsteen lay his vocals down. I loved watching Bob Dylan, Cyndi Lauper, Kim Carnes, Huey Lewis. I loved watching, of course, Lionel Richie and Michael Jackson. and so many highlights throughout the whole entire documentary. Paul Simon, you had Dionne Warwick, Tina Turner. We're talking about the best of the best.
Absolutely.
Especially Tina. She's simply the best.
My God, you're not wrong.
Had to do it.
Of course. But listen, even if We Are the World 25 perhaps didn't live up to some people's expectations,
I do appreciate the effort, of course.
I do appreciate the effort. And what I love so much about We Are the World in general is that it completely changed the face of how we look at collaborations. I mean, it certainly impacted the way, for example, Playing for Change operates, which is a worldwide effort.
Oh, yeah.
And most importantly, and I think it's important to not lose sight of this, I love that We Are the World, at its core, achieved its ultimate mission, which was Harry Belafonte's dream to help Ethiopia, and it continues to do so to this day. It continues to raise money, and it continues to raise awareness.
Yes, speaking of, Eric, since the release, We Are the World has raised over $80 million, which is equivalent to approximately $160 million in 2024 for humanitarian causes in Africa, and continues to raise money to this day, as you said. And following its release, the song achieved significant recognition, of course, winning Record of the Year and Song of the Year at the 1986, that was the following year, Grammy Awards, and a special award at the AMAs, of course, because without the AMAs, that's where it all started to get everybody together.
Exactly. So a lot of accolades that were well-deserved, but what mostly warms my heart is to know that Harry Belafonte's ultimate dream and his ultimate mission was accomplished with this song. And the fact that the finest songwriters of the 80s were able to just grace our airwaves, I would say that's icing on the cake, but we know it's way more than that.
Way more than that. And before we close out this episode, I also want to dedicate it in loving memory of Harry Belafonte.
Rest in peace, good sir. I'm so happy that you were able to see your mission become a success, and your impact is never forgotten.
Michael Jackson.
Of course, rest in peace as well, the undisputed king of pop.
Ken Cragen.
Mastermind behind the whole thing, the one who made it possible.
Ray Charles.
Oh my God, the eternal soul man.
James Ingram.
Oh my God, another legend.
Al Jarreau.
Another one.
Anita Pointer and June Pointer.
Pointer Sisters, also timeless.
Kenny Rogers.
Who also pushed himself beyond his limits and graciously offered his studio to help with the recording efforts.
And last but certainly not least, Tina Turner.
Oh my God. What can we say that hasn't already been said? One of the undisputed queens of rock and roll, and just an overall pioneer and just influence on your favorite singers' favorite singers.
May you all rest in peace. This episode is a tribute to all of those late great singers and their families and everybody that had a part in this song, in this documentary. This is also dedicated to you as well, because we would like to thank you from the bottom of our hearts. We didn't even exist yet. We weren't even a thought yet, Eric and I. We were not born in 1985, but you guys will forever have an impact in music history, and we would like to thank you for impacting our lives and our love of music.
You all made living here on Earth, listening to your music, an absolute heaven, and I'm sure that the actual heaven sounds way more beautiful with you guys up there.
Beautifully said, Eric. Beautifully said. And there you have it, you guys. Those are our thoughts about The Greatest Night in Pop, the behind-the-scenes documentary of the creation of We Are the World. Please, if you haven't and you are intrigued by listening to this episode, please, please, please go check it out. It is currently on Netflix. I will link it down in the description for you guys to check it out for yourselves. And I will also link the music video to the song in the description as well, so you can listen to it and watch. Truly incredible. So guys, we want to know, have you seen this documentary yet? And if you have, what are some aspects that stood out to you? We would like to know who are some of your favorite musicians that are a part of this documentary and the song. We want to know it all, you guys. So make sure you head on over to musicmattersmedia.com and let us know over there. And don't forget to follow us on social media @Music Matters Media, and we'll see ya in the next one.